Welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm delighted to have with me Zal Clemmensen, guitarist from Tear Gas, the sensational Alex Harvey Band, Nazareth, Elkie Brooks, Bonnie Tyler, Majur, Thin Dogs, and his latest venture, Orphans of the Ash. I recently, on the Now Spinning Magazine YouTube channel and website, did a feature on the Alex Harvey Band Next, one of my favourite albums from that period, and it got thousands of views, and lots of people from all around the world started talking about it, how special it was to them. So I'm absolutely honored to actually find myself now talking to Zal, the guitarist from that album. So welcome, Zal, and thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Phil, and I really enjoyed your review of the Next album. That was kind of why I got in touch with you, in a sense, because it was such a heartfelt and in-depth review of the album, and pretty much summed it up as well.
Thank you. Now, I know that your early influences were people like Chuck Berry, and you were also interested in people like Ritchie Blackmore, but I've also read that it was Frank Zappa's guitar style that made you think, right, I'm going in that direction. What was it about Zappa's playing that made you feel? Was it like a relief to let go of all the Jimmy Pages and Blackmores, something about Zappa's playing?
Yeah, I mean, the early stuff, as I say, were all influences, but, you know, in a very particular style, rock guitar, if you want to call it that. From Chuck Berry onwards, everybody that I would imagine playing guitar, play the guitar, not unlike Chuck Berry. You know, it's one of the first things you learn to do in that kind of noise. But when I heard Zappa, it sounded like he wasn't really connected to anything to do with that style of, or that world of cliche, if you like, rock guitar playing. Yeah. He seemed to play the guitar with a kind of freedom and a kind of improvised sort of style that just bent all the rules and everything was out of shape, you know. And I thought, wow, what is this guy doing? And how is he doing it? Because it's quite fascinating to watch Frank Zappa playing the guitar, because your first impression is that he lacks technique.
Yeah.
And he's just simply making things up as he goes along. But when you take the time to analyze it, as his son Dweezil has done, you know, with taking the music to the rest of the world, when you analyze what he's playing, you realize that there's a great musicality to it. That you don't really get the first time. You just hear the strange stuff and you hear the crazy notes and you think, wow. But of course, his education is steeped in classical and jazz music anyway. So there's bound to be that sort of influence.
Yeah, because he was the scales he were playing were very not like the obvious blues scales, were they? So it sounded very alien, didn't it, to what was going on at the time, really?
Yeah, obviously the atonal thing and the sort of parallel fifth idea of you know, composers, the original composer who brought it all together was Stravinsky and people like that. He also was very keen on a composer called Edgar Varese.
Yeah.
So, yes, making use of those sort of scales and those sort of harmonies changed everything. Stravinsky, as I say, changed everything for music, really. And everything you hear nowadays, every soundtrack to a movie from the 1910, 20s onwards owes its debt to Igor Stravinsky, because it's just phenomenal. And you know, we dipped in with Saab, we sort of listened and we tried to dip into a bit of that at the time when we were doing the Rock Drill album. We had the different keyboard player who'd come to join, Tommy Ayer had come to join us. And Tommy himself is very steeped in some of the classical and jazz. Sort of, his big influence was Béla Bartók.
Yeah,
and he would sit in the rehearsal room and just play Bartók on the piano, and we would just sit there open mouthed, you know, and just trying.
Yeah.
So he said he showed us a few tricks and a few tips and a few sort of scales and things that we tried to put into the Rock Drill album. And it worked. It works really well. It translates quite nicely when you play it with a rock sound, you know.
It's a very underrated album from the Alex Harvey catalogue. I mean, when your first band, Tear Gas. I mean, when I've been playing obviously Orphans of the Ash a lot before this interview, and It almost feels like you're going full circle. I mean, Tear Gas was a very hard rock album, not as heavy as obviously Orphans of the Ash because of the technology and the guitar sounds and everything. But there's still an aggressive feel to those first two albums that you did, especially the second one, actually.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've said that to a few people who've asked me that. Yeah, it feels like kind of full circle in a way, going back to with the guitar being the most prominent instrument.
Yeah,
sort of dominating and sort of riff based rock and metal, you know, kind of music with Saab. When Tear Gas sort of morphed into Saab, a lot of the influences came from the keyboards, and a lot of the songs were keyboard sort of driven initially, and yeah, it was all good, it was all great, but for me personally, the guitar kind of took a little bit of a back seat at times. Again, perhaps producers and production techniques that sort of come into it. But yeah, so it was nice to kind of, when I decided to put Sin Dogs together, it was all based upon just let's get a guitar to the fore. And then especially now with Orphans of the Ash, there's only myself and Billy McGonagall. We both play guitar, and we play guitar very similarly. So there's a kind of emphasis that, you know, it's almost 100%. It's just guitar, yeah, bass and drums. And it's kind of, now that we've started work on the second album, it's beginning to show up even more now in that kind of a raw, you know, raw, uncluttered, uncultured almost sort of style of production.
I'm going to jump around a bit probably in this interview, but I have to, yeah, while you've mentioned that, Shed My Skin, which is from, I guess, the new album.
It will be, yeah.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's just a fantastic song. The riffage, the guitar sound is so heavy, and also the version, obviously, that I've heard came with a video. That video is amazing, that's been put together behind that.
Yeah, well, we've been trying desperately to find a way to accompany tracks with a piece of video,
yeah,
without going to Warner Brothers or Steven Spielberg, and and we stumbled on a piece of software called Kyber,
yeah,
which is AI generated, obviously.
Oh yeah,
you pay a little subscription, etc. So we just messed about with it. We played around with some of the ideas. It's quite basic. But you feed it enough information,
and it
spits out a video, and you just kind of go, wow. You know, and
it works really, really well. Going back to, as Tear Gas morphed into the Sensational Alex Harvey Band, and you're talking about some of the songs became more keyboard driven. I mean, some songs like Saint Anthony from Framed is a really heavy song. And I always wondered whether that was kind of something that was from the Tear Gas years, or was it written as the Alex Harvey Band?
No, it was a song Alex himself had. He had that song. Yeah, wow. Yeah, he had that song already written as part of the Framed album. He was, all the songs he brought to the Framed album.
It's a really heavy song, isn't it? Great riff.
It does. Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite songs in lots of ways, because it does have that powerful guitar.
Oh, it's brilliant. It also has that great lyric, Saint Anthony was all alone in the route of a two-tone chocolate biscuit, which I think...
Yeah, surreal lyrics, yeah.
Yeah, I think Alex had a way of seeing the world that was so different to anyone else.
Yeah. I think he had a slight style of, you know, we often hear David Bowie about his lyrics, when he chops up words and throws them around the floor and then picks them up and sees what happens. I wouldn't say Alex was quite in that vein, but he read a lot. He had a great library, and he was very keen on historical references and so on, particularly some of the books, like the Tarzan books, where there was a kind of a hero figure involved, and was a kind of sense of adventure, and so on. So he was I think that has influenced him. Yeah.
Well, I got into Framed after hearing Next, and for a lot of people of my generation, it was the Old Grey Whistle Test in 1973. Staying up late, got school the next day, and got so used to seeing bands all looking roughly the same, and you know, it was album based bands, and then an Alex Harvey band appears, didn't know who you were, what they were, what it was, but everybody in the playground the next day was talking about, did you see the sensational Alex Harvey band, and those two songs, The Faith Healer and Next, in that particular session that you did. Were you aware at the time that when you that was your, I guess, your first real TV exposure in the UK, that something may have shifted from doing this?
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that we were on telly, you know, to us that was like a real kind of step forward. We thought, wow, this is, you know, that's what happens to you when you become successful. You know, you tell yourself that this is what you go through, and to be on the television was an absolute buzz for all of us. And in a way, it was the perfect excuse to present yourself and kind of put on a show, if you like, you know, because the band is obviously, as you say, very visual, very theatrical. Thanks to Alex's direction and mainly from his kind of driving force, his sort of focal point. So yeah, it fell into place quite naturally for us because it was a medium where we could show ourselves off effectively. You could look at a camera, you could express yourself, you could run around, dance about, whatever you want to do, make a face, you know, express yourself in that way. Whereas a lot of bands, you know, with Tear Gas as well in particular, you would just stand there with your head down, play guitar and be mean and moody. And that kind of sap kind of completely knocked that on its head.
Did that theatrical side of the band, because obviously this is 73, hadn't been together that long at all. Was that part of the premise of the band coming together with Alex almost immediately? Did he actually say, this is not going to be a normal rock band, guys?
It wasn't explicit. But with Tear Gas, we had a strange sense of humor. There was a show we played. It was called a club in Glasgow called the Electric Gardens. It's now known as the Garage, and it's quite well known as a sort of rock venue at the moment. But in early Tear Gas days, we played there sort of on a regular basis. And what we did one night was we decided that we would play one half of the show as Tear Gas. And then we went back to the dressing room, shaved our beards off, changed our hair, dressed up like a 50s rock band and called ourselves Johnny Rocket and the Zoomers. And we came wandering back on stage, and half the audience had no idea that it was the same guys. So that was the kind of sensibility that we had. So we had a fairly good tongue-in-cheek approach to it all. So when Alex picked up on that, Alex picked up on the fact that the band liked performing and liked to be theatrical and visual, and so he just brought that out of everybody in a way.
Because the other part, obviously, Alex was the focal point, but not that far behind him was yourself. I mean, because again, so used to it that back in that, again, going back to that performance and how I was, where I was in my musical development, seeing this guitarist dressed as a clown, looking quite sinister, and the way you moved, I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, that was obviously your, what was the inspiration behind that? And was it, did you feel more comfortable being behind a kind of a mask in a way?
Well, the thing about the mask was brought about by when I had a habit of, when I play guitar, I always found that the guitar hero, the image of the guitar hero, I found it quite amusing. The angst that was involved in playing a guitar solo, the stance, the posing, the agony in the face, all the sort of, all of that I found quite ridiculous. And I thought, well, I'll just send it up, which is how I started off. I just started off playing the guitar as if it was, here's a guitar hero, but I'm not taking myself seriously. And what happened was, as the venues got bigger and bigger, our manager, Bill Fahili at the time, said to me, look, people at the back of this hall cannot see what you're doing. They cannot see all of that. So let's see if we can find a way to project. And we tried a few different things, and we played around with things. Actually, was in New York. We went to see Marcel Marceau, the famous mime artist. Yeah, yeah. And that's really where I took the idea for putting the white face and developing it so that it would project further into the hall. And, of course, it became a trademark, and it worked really, really very well.
It certainly did. Now, the album next, the production of that album still sounds as fresh today as it did then. You know, and the guitar sound, I mean, the way that the guitar solo, for example, comes in on Vambo, it's in your face, but it's like, it's balanced within the sound stage as the rest of the music. But it's such a, because again, thinking back to other rock albums of the time, everything was kind of almost in the same frequency band, really. But the way that that album was mixed, it sounds amazing. I mean, what are your thoughts on the production of that album? Were you at the time thinking, this is going to be good?
No, well, actually, it's strange you say that, because for me, I thought from Framed, I thought moving to the production on Next, I thought became a little bit, for me personally, it became a little bit too glossy and a little bit kind of a little bit lightweight. Obviously, it was Phil Wainman who was brought in to produce that album, simply because he'd worked with bands like Sweet and Mudden or whoever else he worked with, it had hit singles, had hit songs. And I think there was at the time an emphasis on making the band sound commercial as these other bands sounded. So you were kind of, and I felt we get dragged towards that to the detriment, really, of the band's over. I know you're saying that you really dig the production, but for me, I still think it could have been a lot heavier. But there you go. You know, the funny thing for me was that at that time, the competition at that time for me wasn't Sweet or Mud or God forbid, Gary Glitter. The competition for me was Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and Deep Purple. That's the kind of band I wanted to be heading in. But we kind of got dragged into this, the Top of the Pops stuff. You know, it was all kind of, it didn't really sit with me comfortably, to be honest.
I think your guitar sound, though, is, thinking about at the start of the Faith Healer, obviously when the riffs come in, and then the guitar overdubs come in when it's ready for Alex to come in. And you did that again on Action Strata as well, that kind of chug, chug, chug sound. It's just, it's you. But the other thing that sets you apart from the other guitar heroes, as you were saying, how the guitar heroes were, I almost felt as the development of guitar and rock music came along, that it became more about the guitarist thinking, right, this is the end of the second chorus now. This is my moment. So there's going to be a solo and I shall pour in as many notes into it as I possibly can. Your star was that the solo was part of the character of the song. It was perfect. It was like structured, not as if it had been plopped on the top of it afterwards. It was part of it, as if the guitar was coming out of the voice or whatever the lyrics had been about. Your guitar matched it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That you've pretty much summed it up there, Phil. That's what Alex would say was, you know, when the vocal stops, whatever takes over has to speak in the similar way. It has to take, if there's no vocal, then where's the emphasis? Where's the attack? Where's the focal point? And if it's a guitar, then for me, the guitar was the voice. Not all of my guitar solos, but I would say at least 80% probably were all improvised, just off the top of my head in the studio. So it was just a case of thinking to yourself, what's going to fit this song? What's going to fit the narrative, if you like? When the vocal stops, you have to say something, you know, you've got to make a statement. So it felt to me like how I approached it, you know, was to make a statement. If you got it right, you got it right. If you hit a few bum notes, you might, well, okay, we do it again. But, you know, generally speaking, it was an improvised sort of situation.
But I think your playing also is not just about, again, which makes you such a great player, is that it's not just about the solos. It's about your chord structures and your songwriting and it is the riffs. Again, thinking of your latest project, Orphans of the Ash, on your 2022 album, you don't so much notice the solos as a separate entity. You just notice the riffs and the song structure and the arrangements, you know, which is obviously, again, it's part of the guitarist world, which I think a lot of people just think of a guitarist like waiting for the solos. But your whole, and again, with Alex, it's the, you're playing throughout the songs. I suppose that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, the Ellipsis album, the Orphans of the Ash, the first album, Ellipsis, we approached it we came at it from sort of different sort of viewpoints in terms of, we wanted it to be kind of atmospheric, but we also wanted it to have a rock edge, but we also wanted it to be at times kind of, use the word cinematic, soundtrack, film, you know, so where there was texture, there was atmosphere, there was tension. So you're trying to, you know, as guitar players, you're trying to, you know, I don't play keyboards. I can play, make a noise and get some strange effects and all that. But so that's how Billy and I approached it. We tried to make the album as expansive as we could, simply because of the way the songs were beginning to develop in the music. And it was like, well, okay, is this a song or is this a piece of music? Or, you know, are they two standalone things, or do we put them together? So that was a very interesting process for us. It works on some occasions. Other occasions, I think it's a little bit where we sort of miss the target occasionally, but overall, it's not bad as a first production.
I agree. I think it's very cinematic. The opening track, Evolution Road, is very kind of dystopian, melancholy. It sounds like it. You could imagine in some kind of dystopian sci-fi movie. The guitar sound when it comes in after that almost gentle beginning is just in your face and so well recorded. It's a great album. I said we'd be jumping around in this interview. And just popping back to Alex, I mean, after Next, that was when the band really took off. And I think living through the 70s, like we all did, I think the only thing missing then was MTV, in respect to the fact that Alex Harvey Band was such a visual, theatrical band, that if MTV or that kind of medium had been around, YouTube, then I think Alex Harvey Band would have been like one of the biggest draws on the planet. I mean, because you were so visual, nothing really exists, does it, to show that off to people apart from Top of the Pops and a few.
There's some various footage from here and there and everywhere. There was one that was done for America, which we did at the Rainbow.
Yeah.
The Rainbow, which was, I think it was Don Kitchener or some sort of in concert type thing or something, which went out to the States. There's some footage from a couple of festivals, one in particular from the Ragnarok, I think, in Norway. So, yeah, there is some footage. There's some footage from the Marquee, I think, as well, a version of St. Anthony that you mentioned.
Oh, great. There's
little snippets of the band, but not enough. We did one of the tours we did of the UK became known as the Christmas shows.
Yeah.
Which was done at that time, which was five nights at the Apollo in Glasgow, and I think it was four nights at the Victoria in London, somewhere like that. All sold out. So it was quite an event, and it was quite a production in terms of the stage and the visuals and all that, the theatrics and so on. And it never, that would have been, that was for me the band's pinnacle. And if that why that wasn't filmed and why that wasn't videoed, or, you know, however you did it at the time, was absolute, that was just sacrilege. It was just, yeah, you know, well, yeah, and you're right.
I totally agree. I mean, the band was becoming more adventurous with The Impossible Dream and Tomorrow Belongs to Me with Give My Compliments to the Chef, The Great Stone Eater, etc. These are all songs that would have been fantastic. You imagine videos being done nowadays. And of course, you had the live album, which should have been a double. At least.
Yeah, a lot of people reckon the live album's the best. But, you know, their favourite album. And for me, production-wise, it's excellent.
Yeah. Totally. The Pentaz tapes, which had a lot of cover versions on, was that, can you remember, was that like a deliberate thing to think, let's do an album with covers, or was it a kind of a...
No, well, thinking back now, I think it became, I think it was the time around about when Alex's health was perhaps not great. I don't know, there was various other things that had happened. I'm not sure of the complete timeline, but we had a contract with the record company, obviously, to spit out, I think it was, you know, like two albums a year or something like that.
Yeah, ridiculous, really.
So it was kind of nonstop. It was a kind of conveyor belt of, you know, writing, recording, touring, rehearsing, etc. And I think what really happened there was that probably Alex had run out of some ideas. You know, we were short of ideas, and we just had to complete a kind of a contractual. So it was maybe just pick some songs, and Alex picked some. I think we all had a sort of hand in it. For me, it was all a bit kind of, it didn't quite work for me. I didn't see the point of doing a version of Schools Out that wasn't really as good as the original, or a version of Crazy Horses even that wasn't even as good as the original. So it was a bit of a stopgap, I think.
Yeah.
And you're right, it didn't, I don't think it really advanced us in any way. Yeah.
No, and I think the light was starting to dim a little bit, unfortunately, because obviously Stories, which came out, I think, afterwards, is a very strong album. Boston Tea Party is on it, isn't it? And it's one of my favourites from the band. But as you say, Alex's health was starting to wane. And then...
And Hugh as well. Hugh suffered an extreme breakdown just before we started to do rock drill, work on rock.
Do you think was that because of, like, literally how you were being worked by the record company and the management back then?
I think in Alex's case, I would say yes. In Hugh's case, it was more to do with sort of early adventures and taking acid and things like that, and he never quite recovered, I don't think, fully health wise. You know, mentally, psychologically.
Yeah, yeah.
Alex went downhill when Bill Fihili, our manager, was killed in a plane crash. And there was nobody in charge of Mountain. The management company just completely fell to pieces. The band's finances were completely and utterly destroyed and decimated. And, you know, the whole thing was completely mismanaged extremely badly. And I think Alex didn't really recover from any of that. And he just, you know, he took himself to his own room after gigs. You know, he was dragging a bottle of vodka from the dressing room, taking it away into his bedroom. And it was all that sort of stuff, you know. Yeah. It was almost a classic kind of a rock and roll kind of trip.
And when the band unfortunately did fold, I mean, the management were obviously keen to try and keep something going, and that's where the Zal band came from, was it? But that didn't last very long.
No, again, it was ill-fated. The whole thing was just an attempt to keep some sort of momentum. The record company weren't sure what they should be doing. It was just, well, who's next in line? Like you said earlier, Alex, well, who's next in line? Oh, Zal, right, okay. You know, he's got an image. Let's see if we can build something around that. And it was all... the music was actually quite remarkably interesting at times, because I went back to my Frank Zappa roots and started to write stuff was a little more involved, more complicated, more jazz, more time signatures. All the whole thing was more fusion. So it was musically it kind of was cool, because Ted and Tris were obviously still involved, and it was. But yeah, as a project, it was extremely disjointed.
Because around this time, you mentioned that obviously the finances were all over the place, and I think you had to get like a normal job to keep things ticking over during this period. And I think a lot of people don't appreciate that when you're a musician, you don't necessarily get a regular monthly paycheck. Money arrives randomly depending on what you did 2 years ago. So this must have been very difficult. For, you know, to mentally get
I'll give you the whole truth. I mean, when we first started, when Tear Gas became the Alex Harvey band, we each of us were earning £100 a week, and then that quickly, fairly quickly, that went to £200 a week. And at that time, that was fair enough. It paid
your
bills.
There's a lot back then.
It was a decent enough wage. So we never saw any royalties. We were never given any songwriting royalties, PRS, PPL, mechanicals. We never saw any of that. We were just around £200 a week. And we thought, right, okay, that pays the bills. And as you say, up until the time when the band split, that's what we were earning. The money that had been brought in from record sales and so on, we never saw that. The management company took it and pissed it away somewhere. I don't know. When Mount Management went into liquidation, our management company, we were each of us were sent a letter from a solicitor to say that each of us owed the company £75,000. So this is a band that headlined the Reading Festival and et cetera, et cetera. And we're all sitting saying to ourselves, how come, you know, what, you know, anyway, you get the idea.
I get the idea, yeah. I get the idea.
So when it split up, I turned around to my wife and we were living in North London. We had a baby at the time as well. And I turned around and said, well, where am I going to earn £200 a week? So I says, oh, I'll drive a minicab. Been in enough minicabs in London to realise that you could drive 12 hours a day and make a bunch of money. And that's exactly what I did. Just a local radio company, you know, a car company.
Wow. And from there, you obviously, Nazareth were next on the list. Did you join, I mean, you made two, from my perspective, two fantastic albums with Nazareth, No Mean City and Malice in Wonderland. And I love them both. But this must have been very different for you because you were coming out not wearing your mask from Alex Harvey. So you were just being Zal on stage. What was your experience looking back on that now, being in Nazareth?
Well, the Naz guys were part of the same management team. We were all under the same umbrella, Mountain Management, as it was known. They kind of, in a way, sort of owned the company, I guess. And so we knew each other extremely well. We were all pals. We sort of, at times, we would share the same flat in London. When they were away, we would stay in the flat. When we were away, they would stay in the flat. But, and then we had an opportunity. We were asked by Manny and Roger Glover to play on Dan McCafferty's solo album.
Oh, yeah.
So we all went in, all four of us from Saab, and became the sort of studio band for that. Which was a nice album, nice songs, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that was where the first connection was made. And then I got a call from Manny, you know, the late 79, I don't exactly know when it was, to say, well, what are you doing? Would you want to come out? They were recording No Mean City in a mobile studio on the Isle of Man, again, tax reasons. And they said, would you want to come over? They said, do you want to come over and see what we're doing, hear what we're doing? I said, yeah, okay. So I flew over to the Isle of Man. Listen to it. And I think at that time they were looking for a bit of input, looking for a bit of songwriting input, you know, to just sort of maybe spread the music a bit more and develop the music a bit more. And I had a few ideas been lying around. Obviously, I never stopped writing, so I took a few ideas with me, and they ended up on that particular album, the No Mean City album. So yeah, I kind of fell into the position in a way. And then they flew me out to America to see just how big they were, I guess, in a way, because they were playing like stadiums and things like that. And it was a bit of an eye opener. I thought, well, wow, they'd really had a big success with Love Hurts and a couple of the other Hair of the Dog albums and so on. So that was a kind of way for them to try and sort of say, look, you know, they entice me into this world of stadium rock. And I thought, yeah, okay, why not? I'll just, I just fell into it, really.
And so, because Malice in Wonderland was a different type of album, different sounding album, and you wrote some, you know, co-wrote and wrote some great songs on that record. But soon after that, you decided this was not really where you wanted to be. What was it that made you wanted to move on?
Well, with Malice in Wonderland, recording in the Bahamas, again, tax reasons. And Jeff Baxter from Steely Dan, the Doobie Brothers, he produced the album. He turned up in the Bahamas with a sack full of cocaine and just produced the album. And that was one of those scenarios. But anyway, it was all right. It was all right. It never struck me as being something that seemed a bit lightweight in terms of a production for me. But anyway, Yeah, and then it got to a stage where we were all back home, and you know, we were up in Dunfermline, up, but the guys lived in Dunfermline. I was living in London, and I came up, and they were saying, right, okay, we're going to be starting another album. We need the material. And I thought, yeah, okay, well, who's going to provide that? And they all just sort of, I felt they were all looking at me, mm-hmm. saying, yeah, you're going to come up with all the songs, aren't you, Sal? And I thought, really? Yeah. And because again, it was like I was on a wage, and it was not, I know I wasn't getting any royalties. I wasn't getting any.
Oh, right.
There was, so it was all felt a bit like, nah, it's time for me to get out of here and take my ideas somewhere else.
And the next place you went, and I actually bought this, everybody, was Tandoori Cassette. I remember buying the single. I know it was only a blink of an eye, but it was there. Did you have high hopes for that? But it was very different to what you'd done before.
Yeah, it was Barry Barlow, the drummer from Tull. We toured the States supporting with Saab. We toured the States supporting Jethro Tull for an entire tour, and we got to know the guys fairly well. And it was Barry who got in touch with me to say, look, do you want to come down? He had a house down in Henley by the river, and he had a studio in his garage and all that. It was quite a nice rehearsal sort of room with a kind of studio. And he says, do you want to try and put something together? And we said, yeah, why not? He's a fantastic drummer, a great player. And we started to put lots of interesting ideas down. We brought in Ronnie Leahy, the keyboard player that I knew from Scotland way back. We played with Stone the Crows and various other people. And then there was Charlie Tumahai, the bass player from Bebop Deluxe, who was a Maori guy from New Zealand. And great musicians, all great musicians. So musically, it was really very, very interesting. The songs were interesting. There was the kind of hints of Peter Gabriel, who's my most favorite songwriter of all time. So there was influences that were nice, and it was going quite well. But in terms of a project, in terms of an image or a band or where does this band sit in the scheme of things, we felt very much out on a limb somewhere. You know, we never really felt that there was any kind of powerful commercial, you know, the way of putting it all on a paying basis, you know.
Well, I guess that, as you say, it must be looking for some kind of steady financial income as well. And your next kind of turn was to go to Elkie Brooks and then Major and Bonnie Tyler. Did these collaborations influence your musical journey? Because it must be very different style of music. Was it just a case of you playing what was, if you weren't, were you involved in any aspect of writing, or was it just doing the two?
It was pretty stuff. Much a session gig, really. You know, I approached it as a session musician, you know, just like, show me the tune, I'll play the part. But no, there was, with Elkie, there was a little bit of flexibility, even though her music at that time, the songs at that time were very much geared to a kind of a more of a, I don't know what the word for it is, slightly sort of softer, you know, approach. She'd moved away from the Vinegar Joe, the sort of real stuff.
She still had, there was still room for guitars, though, because she'd had Jeff Whitehorn had played with her.
Jeff, fantastic. But yeah, that I took over from Jeff, and that was...
Oh, right.
He left all these parts for me to learn. So I thought, yeah, thanks a lot, Jeff. And he did a beautiful arrangement of Nights in White Satin, which Elkie made a fantastic job of. And there's a great, great guitar part in that. She also did Money, the Pink Floyd track, Money, which was cool, you know. And there's a couple of other little blues things that we did that were nice. I wrote a song for her called Minutes, which was this title song from the Minutes album. So there was a great deal of enjoyment, and she's a wonderful lady to work for, as was Bonnie Tyler. They were both.
Yeah.
The funny thing about Bonnie was that we never ever played live. She just played to a tape and sang. We just stood on stage and jumped about like
really?
Dummies. Yeah, everybody says that. Yeah, really. Yeah. Because when I first got the chance to do the gig, I was sitting at home learning all these guitar parts, which are pretty. They're pretty heavy duty at times with some of Bonnie's, the Jim Steinman production, you know. So here's me at home learning all these guitar parts, thinking, yeah, that'll be good, that'll be great. And when I turned up, to the first rehearsal. It was just the tape they put on, and we just stood there without just mimed everything.
Well, I suppose it took the pressure off.
That's the way it went. That's the way it went for a couple of years with her. You know, it was just crazy.
How interesting. Well, I know. Well, I was with Midger. This is a question from one of my subscribers, because I think Midger's album, The Gift, is being reissued this year.
Yeah.
And it comes with a live disc from the tour, and my subscriber actually saw you on that tour, and he asked, wanted to know, what was your thoughts on playing with Midge? What was he like? He actually says your playing was just absolutely superb.
Well, it's very structured. It's very much you play what's written down, you know.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a great deal of scope for anything to be bent out of shape or improvised as it was, you know, with other bands. But Midge himself was a very accomplished guitarist, you know, so the guitar parts were really pretty slick and they were pretty nicely done. And we enjoy, I mean, we'd never met each other, but when we first met, it felt like we'd known each other all our life. We both come from Glasgow and we're both kind of, you know, similar sort of background. So it was a really nice time. And then the music, okay, a little bit poppy for me in places, but other times it was really cool. It was nice to do. I mean, you know, the production that he wanted from a live situation was very slick. It was very very polished, very professional, and Midge himself was absolutely superb. So yeah, it was no hardship, you know.
And then the 90s is a difficult time for lots of musicians from the 70s and 60s, because there was so much going on in the world, really. And for yourself, I think you had to again look at different ways of bringing some money in. But towards the end of that, the return of the Sensation Alex Harvey Band appeared. Because of all the bands that when they reform and they lose a key member, it was called Alex Harvey, and Alex Harvey was no longer there. So did you think at some time on paper, I'm not even sure we should even be thinking about this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly how I thought about it. But Ted McKenna, the drummer, he had a sort of a bee in his bonnet about kind of keeping things alive and keeping the memory and also and he tried to get me back. You know, I'd stopped playing for quite a number of years. Hadn't played the guitar at all for quite a number of years. And Ted had moved back to Glasgow. And I was just about to move back to Glasgow as well. And so we kind of, he says, come down, well, let's just knock things around, see what we can do. And it kind of snowballed. You know, we did some impromptu gigs with a bass player called Alan Thompson, who's played with John Martin and some various people. But yeah, so we kind of started to get into that sort of guitar fusion jazz thing, which was cool. But and then Ted said, well, maybe we can roll this into something else. And it became a kind of a regular gig in a little Glasgow club in the south side of Glasgow, with like guest musicians. Fish came and sang, Dan came and sang, and this guy called Stevie Doherty got up and sang. He was a Glasgow singer with a fantastic voice, voice for that type of, you know, stadium rock, some people call it cock rock, I suppose, but, you know, and the Bon Jovi type sort of.
Yeah, I know what you mean,
Foreigner sort of vibe, which has never appealed to me greatly, I have to say. But the thing was that Ted said, well, this guy's a great singer. Maybe he could be the new Alex. We'll put him in front of the band. And so we put together a kind of a revamped version of Sab, rekindled that, and with Stevie Doherty singing, and we did a few gigs. We did a gigs here and there. But we realized eventually that it was the wrong person, the wrong persona, you know, and perhaps even the wrong voice to take over from Alex, or even try and do that. And then, so that drifted and fell apart. And then again, I think there's a few years passed, and then Ted came back to me and says, look, there's another guy in Glasgow called Max Maxwell, who's very visual, very theatrical. And we had a rehearsal with him, and I thought, I loved Max. I thought he was fantastic. I thought, this guy's got something, you know, he had personality, and perhaps not the greatest singer on the planet, but he had something about him. You know, he had a very visual, very, you know, very sort of theatrical sort of presentation. And it was his enthusiasm that forced me in the way to say, yeah, okay, let's do it. And that's when I decided to get dressed up and put the face back on again.
Yeah. It was a revamped face, wasn't it, as well, a different, more.
Yeah. We changed the look of it a little bit, give it a bit more of a modern kind of a sci-fi sort of look. But that was another attempt at being Saab. And it got so far, and it played certain places, and we did a sellout gig at the ABC in Glasgow, which was cool. But again, I was desperate to move on. You know, what I wasn't wanting to do was become a parody of myself. And I felt that that's what it was, you know, and I tried to introduce, like, here's some new song ideas, guys, let's try doing some fresh new songs. And it was just met with almost zero enthusiasm. And I thought, bugger this, I'm not, you know, I'm just not going to go. I didn't want to go up and prance about dancing Delilah for the rest of my life. Because it just felt like that's just static. It's not going anywhere. It's not doing anything.
Is that when you announced you were going to retire from live performances completely around 2000?
Yeah, it was about that time. Yeah, there was various other things going on in my life. My marriage was falling apart. It was all a bit of a traumatic sort of experience. And I met another woman, etc. I moved back down to live in Yorkshire with this woman, and so on. And that lasted about 15 years. Only a couple of years back that we split up again. But yeah, so there was a lot of personal things going on, a lot of emotional things happening at that time. So I wasn't really fully focused on anything.
Did because obviously it's a big, you've gone through different parts of your career when you've literally put the guitar down and not picked it up for a long time. And as a musician, the pilot light never goes off. It's somewhere in the background.
Very good expression. Good metaphor.
As much as you think, it doesn't bother me anymore. As rusty as the guitar strings get, the pilot light's still on. So at some point, did you see that music could actually be part of your healing process to get back to?
Well, it's funny that you use it. It's very interesting that you use that word, healing. Because as I say, when I met this other woman, we moved, her job took us out to Cyprus, and we lived in Cyprus for 3.5-4 years.
Yeah.
And during that time, I suffered an extremely serious mental breakdown due to depression and anxiety and so on. And it was horrendous, a horrendous time.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, right, well, you know, I need to do something. I need to do something. I need to get out of this. I need to find a way to heal myself, as you say. And I thought, right, I had a little acoustic guitar with me, nothing else. I picked it up, started strumming the guitar and just to see where it would take me. And of course, things began to snowball a little bit. I started to get ideas, started to feel it was songs, some guitar riffs. I went along to the music shop in Limassol in Cyprus, got myself an electric guitar for 100 quid, got a little Black Star amp for 100 quid, plugged it in, started playing some riffs. And it was therapy. That's what it was, you know. And then I started to feel that, you know, there was something happening here. And I got in touch with there was a band in Glasgow who played like a Saab tribute band, actually.
Yeah.
And with a keyboard player called David, I got in touch with David, and asked him
David Cowan, was it?
David Cowan, David Cowan. And asked him if he would like to, you know, add some keyboards, do some recording, you know, with some of these ideas. I was in Cyprus, he was in Glasgow, we were passing things back and forward until eventually it was beginning to sound interesting enough to try and put a band together around the whole idea. And that became a band called Sin Dogs. And we did a kind of an album that was okay.
And because that almost Sin Dogs becomes Orphans of the Ash, doesn't it, in some ways? And also during this time, you've decided to write a post-apocalyptic book novel called Rule. Is that still?
Yeah, it's in the back burner at the moment because the music has kind of taken. But yeah, I've been writing this novel for quite a number of years now. Yeah, it's called Rule, R-O-O-L. Yeah, it's set in the future. It's kind of about evolution. It's about things evolving, creatures evolving, insects evolving, and humans morphing into whatever. So it's quite a freaky sort of story. And I've got a couple of the first chapters already completed, but I need to get back to it. I need to organize it. I need to get my brain in gear and just get myself, kick myself up the arse and spend some time doing it.
The Shed My Skin video kind of links really well into whatever you fed into the AI system. I can obviously see where that came from.
Yeah, you used the word earlier, dystopian. The whole thing, the whole planet's becoming a kind of a dystopian nightmare, I guess, as we speak. But
isn't it just? Yeah. That the Ellipsis album is superb.
Good to hear. Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Ratneck, Psychodrama, Blind Machine, Starship Baby Boo, Jesus Strange. There's not a bad track on it. Some of it's really heavy, isn't it? Really almost thrash metal in places. I mean, a lot of musicians kind of mellow as they go through life. You seem to be raging against the machine and heading in the opposite direction.
you've picked the right band as well there. But yeah. Yeah, Willie and I have a tendency to lean towards, having an attitude to playing the guitar that never really sort of wanes. And we just love that style of rock music, I guess. I mean, our musical tastes are very, very similar. And in fact, the favorite music for me, the favorite bands that I would listen to now would be bands like Radiohead and Soundgarden. Mm-hmm. That's the two bands that have had the biggest influence on the Ellipsis album for me. There's more grunge than metal, but it's still a noise you want to make. You want to plug that guitar in and hear it screaming and thumping away. So yes, it never leaves you.
So tell me about the next one then, because obviously I've heard the forthcoming track. But I mean, what's the new album? What are the plans for? When's that going to be finished or coming out?
Yeah, we'd love to have it finished by the end of the year. We don't have a lot of time to work together. The studio's in Billy's house on the west, just near where I live as well. We live quite close to each other, but he's out cutting hedges. He works for the council. He cuts grass and hedges and, central roundabouts and central reservations and things like that, just to make, to pay the bills again. It's one of those situations. But so when we get together, we work pretty swiftly. But the approach really is to even strip things back even further than Ellipsis, is to get back to an even more very, very... like, let's have one guitar instead of double tracking. Let's just have one guitar do the job and see where we go with that. So that's how we've kind of, our mindset at the moment is to strip everything right back to White Stripes are kind of a prime example. Royal Blood again is a sort of prime example of things being stripped right back to the bare bones. But the noise that comes out is extremely pleasing. We're kind of working along those lines, if you like,
Who's playing bass on the Ellipsis?
They're electronic basses and drums.
It's a wonderful industrial.
Yeah, that's sound, it's called Easy Drummer and Easy Bass. And they're like plugins. You use it with Pro Tools, the recording software Pro Tools.
Yeah.
You just plug in this module and it spits out a drum kit. You've got to program it, and program the bass. But the noise is fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic sound. You mentioned about your writing partner and he has to do other things and stuff. The music industry has changed so much over the years. And for musicians now to try and earn a living, etc. I mean, what are your thoughts on like streaming and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not that kind of clued up on the technology of it all, but it's something. It seems to be the only way that you can get your music out to the public is to just, when we did the Ellipsis album, we said, "Well, here's a CD," and I thought CDs. It seemed like we were going back to the dark ages, people. But it's funny because most of the people that follow me on Facebook are probably of an age where CDs is exactly what they want. They don't want to download. They want the physical product.
Yeah, to give you some background, I mean, on for my subscriber base is probably age between 30 and 65 plus, and they do stream, but they use streaming to discover and to listen. But then if they like something, they'd like to buy the CD or the vinyl album directly from the artist. Because people like to have that tangible bit of art in their hands, because you're closer to you as a creator of the music than you would be by just pressing a file name to see what it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you just mentioned the vinyl there again. There's a company in Sweden who are doing a vinyl version of Ellipsis as we speak.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that'll be out within weeks, I would have thought. That's what I've been told. It's going to be ready within weeks.
Well, that's really really exciting.
It's a short run, I guess, but they were very, very keen.
So
that will be, they had to cut down the track lengths, obviously, to get things on the vinyl. We took out Jesus Strange. And so the slower sort of songs, we took them out to give ourselves more space.
Because of their running time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the vinyl idea is cool, but the point you made was that there's not a lot, there's no money to be made really unless your profile is massive and huge. And people keep asking, on Facebook, they keep saying, are we going to get live shows from Orphans of the Ash? Are we going to get live gigs? And it's Billy and I look at each other and think, putting together a band, it's not out of the question, but it's let's say it's the last thing in line, put it that way.
I think from my perspective, I talked to quite a few up and coming bands as well, is that a lot of people and a lot of rock fans are from a certain age, and I'm one of them. There's a tendency for some of us to look backwards, to look back to, back to the glory days of how we perceive them as being like these classic albums from this certain time. And then the new music, the great new music, which is hiding in plain sight, by the same artists that we loved, we're not aware of, or for new bands who are struggling to break through, we're not even aware of it. And I think, we're reaching a point now where you've got lots of older artists who are either going to retire or other things will happen to them, and we need to support new music from musicians young and old. And I think, I want to try and hope for this is for those of you listening, is to listen to this Ellipsis album by Orphans of the Ash, because you will love it. It's absolutely stunning.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more with everything you've just said.
We need to support music as it is now.
It's where and how you present your product. How do you get that product to the right audience? I don't know. Television, video, YouTube.
YouTube probably. I'd say. I think your little video of Shed My Skin needs to be out there. It's brilliant anyway. You've got such a legacy as well. There's a guitarist called Guthrie Govan who plays with Stephen Wilson, he describes you as his Jimmy Page. how does that make you feel now that you've had such an effect on?
Well, I've been to see Guthrie playing, and it's flattering for him to even mention my name in that sort of light. But but obviously at his age, at that age, when he was first hearing perhaps Led Zeppelin and Tear Gas or whatever, or Saab, etc., there was, Jimmy Page is a big hero of mine, obviously, from way back. But very, very pleasing, because of the style of guitar player that he is a style of guitar playing that I kind of drifted into when I mentioned to you before about the fusion, the jazz thing. Yeah. And we were working with the tail end of rock drill, and we were moving into certain things. And Ted and I were playing in Glasgow together. It was mainly fusion type guitar instrumentals, the Jeff Beck style Guthrie Govan style. So, a lot of compatibility there, and it's cool to be mentioned in that way. It really is.
Well, fantastic, Zal. Well, thank you very much. But before I sign off, where's the best place for people to buy the Ellipsis album and Orphans of the Ash? Is it from directly from your website?
Well, okay, the website is down for the time being.
Okay,
we've decided that we can't afford the website, so we're going to go. We're just about to switch over now to just social media sites.
Okay,
so we have a couple of young lads in Glasgow who manage all our affairs. They're putting together the package now to relaunch, as it were, on the media sites, social media. They want to relaunch Ellipsis along with the free download of Shed My Skin with the video as a kind of taster for what's coming. So that package is in the process of being built as we speak. It will be ready within a week or two.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, I'll put a link to the Orphans of the Ash Facebook page.
That's the one. That's the one where it will appear. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll put a link to that at the in the description in the podcast and on the website, so people know where they can go and find out more about how they can buy a copy of the previous album and look forward to the new one as well.
Absolutely.
That'd oh, and the great. Vinyl one, great. Of course.
Yeah. Great, Phil. Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much, Zal. Thank you. And thank you to everyone who's been listening. And please remember to check out Orphans of the Ash on the Facebook page, where you can find about where you can buy the CDs. And please subscribe to Now Spinning Magazine podcast as well. And a big thank you to my guest, Zal Clemmingson, for joining me today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
A big thank you to my guest, Zal Clemmingson. What a guitarist and what a musical history this guy has had, from Alex Harvey, Nazareth, Elkie Brooks, Bonnie Tyler, Mujer, Sin Dogs, and his latest project, Orphans of the Ash. Everybody, I know we love Alex Harvey. I know you love Nazareth, and many of us want to love those stories that Zal's been talking about. But please support his latest venture, Orphans of the Ash, an absolutely incredible heavy metal, grungy metallic music album full of absolute total 100% riffage. It's dystopian, it's melancholy, it's absolutely superb. And listen to it, Ellipsis on Spotify. There's going to be a vinyl version out very, very soon, and the new album is out soon as well. And also the single Shed My Skin, which is off the new album, give that a listen as well. And trust me, if you're into rock music, you will love it. So thank you again, Zal. And please keep a check on Zal's Facebook page to see what he's up to. And please subscribe to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast and YouTube channel. Become a patron, become a member, and I shall see you and hear you and talk to you on my next episode.